This is a rebroadcast of Migrant Matters. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
I'm happy to have the CFRU Guelph studio, a member of the Committee for the Reimbursement of the Indemnity Money Extorted from Haiti, also known as the acronym CRIME, and her name is Laurence Fabre. In French, they're Le Comité de Remboursement de Extorque. In both languages, the acronym is CRIME or CRIME in French. To begin, who is CRIME?
Well, we came together over the past year. We are French citizens, Americans, Canadians, Quebecois, and we came together to deal with the issue of restitution of Haiti's independence debt. So that is the debt that Haiti was forced to pay in 1825 when King Charles X demanded compensation for former French slave owners. 21 years before, Haiti had won independence, defeating Napoleon's armies militarily and paying a very high price in human lives. About 40% of Haiti's original population, which was largely comprised of slaves in the French colony that had been known as Saint-Domingue, were killed. So about 40% of the population killed during the Haitian Revolution. But independence was won in 1804. Haiti became an independent nation, a republic, the Second Republic of the Americas, the first modern nation to abolish slavery, and the first black-led republic. But it faced enormous international pressure following independence from the Western nations, who still relied on slavery as a central component of their economies. And so trade from the United States, from countries in Europe, was cut off. Haiti was facing an economic embargo from all of these countries because it had dared to abolish slavery at a time when the slave trade was a huge part of the economy of the whole Western world. And so facing this economic pressure, and also with the challenges of recovering from this long war of independence that had resulted in tremendous devastation, environmental and economic, to Haiti, in 1825, facing warships, a flotilla of warships sent by the French monarch, King Charles X, and the imminent threat of the reimposition of slavery and military occupation by the French government, Haiti's leaders capitulated and agreed to pay compensation to France for the slaves who had won their independence, which the French considered to be lost French property, which was unjustly stolen from them.
What are CRIME's demands? And CRIME, again, stands for the Committee for the Reimbursement of the Indemnity Money Extorted from Haiti.
The demand is very simple: the restitution of this illegally extorted indemnity that Haiti was forced to pay to France. And that, incidentally, it left Haiti with a debt that it was paying off until 1947. Even in 1825, under King Charles X, this demand for Haiti to pay France was not legal. France was already a signatory to two international treaties that called for the eradication of the slave trade. And the payment of the indemnity represented an enormous transaction that was part of the slave trade. So by France's own laws and the international laws France had signed on to, it was patently illegal at the time. Now it is 2011. Haitians are still paying through the lack of infrastructure that in their country, which results directly from the fact that they were paying for decades this illegal sum to compensate the French. And it's high time that this money was returned.
Mm-hmm. What action did CRIME do on July 14th last year?
Yeah, so we decided last year to use the occasion of Bastille Day, the French national holiday, which is supposed to commemorate the French Republican values of liberty, equality, and fraternity. we decided to use this holiday to make an announcement. We announced, and this was a prank inspired by the work of the Yes Men, who are notorious global pranksters who have really done phenomenal work in showing the public how you can use a prank to demonstrate a truth that is hidden in the media. So we used these tactics and staged an announcement that France would pay Haiti back the indemnity that France had demanded of Haiti. Now, the amount originally was 150 million gold francs, 10 times Haiti's annual revenues in 1825. It was later lowered to 90 million gold francs, but it was still such a great burden that it took until the Second World War for Haiti to pay it off. And we announced that this sum would be paid back with interest, and a minimal interest rate, about 4% a year, and with adjustments for inflation. So the total, we know in 2003, it came to $21 billion, including minimal interest and inflation, because the Haitian government had actually made a demand in 2003 for France to return the money. So we went by that figure, which is quite a conservative estimate, because now we're in 2010 when we made the announcement. So we announced that France was going to pay Haiti back to the tune of $21 billion. And we put the announcement in video form on a website that looked similar to the French government's foreign ministry's own website. And we called it the Bastille Day Framework Initiative for Haiti's Reconstruction. And it came out around the time of the six-month anniversary of the earthquake in Haiti. And we managed to get quite a lot of media pickup, because there were a lot of questions at that time in the media about how the money was going to be raised for Haiti's reconstruction after the earthquake. And so we inserted this prank into the media discussion about Haiti's reconstruction as sort of a bold proposal. Well, this is pretty simple. Why doesn't France just pay Haiti back? Problem solved.
That's great. Now, what was the response of the French Foreign Ministry to this prank?
Well, the French Foreign Ministry wasn't amused. They immediately announced that they were investigating who was behind the hoax, and they also announced that they were considering taking legal action against us. I started getting bizarre text messages from an attaché of information security at the French Foreign Ministry, who eventually told me that I would personally have to pay, and he told me he was in touch with the people who were going to arrest me. I still haven't been arrested, luckily, and there has been no further word from the French government about this supposed pending legal action. But they certainly talked it up a lot in media interviews in the wake of the hoax. And they were suggesting that they were really seriously considering taking legal action against us. But at the same time, I heard from a very well-placed French journalist that there were also members of the French government who were calling the French Foreign Ministry right after the hoax took place and congratulating their colleagues on the best foreign policy decision France had made in decades. So that was encouraging, because it shows that not everybody in the French government is so is beholden to this idea that discussion about the issue should just be simply shut down.
Mm-hmm.
But officially, that's what France's position has been.
And so the planning for this prank, how long were you guys working on that for?
Well, we basically came up with the idea about a year and 5 months ago today, and there were initially a crew of maybe 5 of us who were really excited about it, and then we decided it would make sense to try to do it on Bastille Day, partly because the French government would be on holiday. And I would say then it was about 2 months of solid work, with myself working on it pretty much full time. Like, that was my unpaid job, was to work on this prank and make sure it all came together. And we had amazing, amazing volunteer work put in by so many people to make it happen, including an activist in Montreal who pretended to be a spokesperson of the French government, and people who came together to help edit it, to help edit sound, to help with just arranging the flags behind the woman who is making the announcement. So it was an extraordinary community effort in several communities, really, because we started filming in New York and went through a whole take that then had to be scrapped because our first model of French government official looked somehow about 16 years old on camera. So we had to retake the whole thing. And yeah, but I would say about 2 months of solid work, and then with different people at different times playing a greater role.
Has there been an attempt to shut Crime's site down?
Yeah, the French government did manage to shut the original site down.
Oh, okay.
We had originally put up the site at Diplomatie, D-I-P-L-O-M-I-E, G-O-V, so diplomatiegov.fr, and the French government shut that down. I think it was by the end of the week that we launched the prank. So just a few days after the prank was launched, they shut that down. But then we remounted it at the exact same URL, except instead of ending .fr, it ended .info. Aww. And we got the New York Times to announce in advance that the new URL was, and because we offered it to them as a scoop. So we managed to make the transition to the point info quite smoothly, and we used the French government's action in shutting the site down as an additional news hook to keep the story alive. So, I mean, it's a bit like jujitsu when you're taking on the French government, and, you know, like you're like maybe you're – there was a team of about – really about five of us. And we had no budget whatsoever. We just had the time we were willing to put in because we were really dedicated to making sure this happened right. And then we're up against the French government. And in the media landscape, the problem we were in the first instance trying to address is that there is this crucial historical context that is missing in every single story where you see a discussion of Haiti. Invariably, first line, Haiti, the poorest country of the Western Hemisphere. And you never have an explanation for why it is poor. Sometimes, increasingly, I think, in the media we hear Haiti won its independence in 1804 in the world's only successful slave revolt. It's often not called a revolution, it's called a revolt. Mm-hmm. And then it's sort of, but now it's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And there's this huge missing piece of the puzzle, which is that it was forced to pay reparations to slave owners. You never see that context in the media. And I think for journalists who are working in the corporate media, they would likely not get it past their editors to add that historical context, or they don't think of it. It's hard to know exactly what the factors are. But in the commercial media, it's the kind of historical context that is almost invariably missing. And for anybody who is trying to really understand the present context in Haiti, it's absolutely indispensable. So we were faced with this problem of how do we get that context talked about in the media? And we'd seen it had been tried before under Haiti's elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. There was a campaign that was mounted by the government, elected government of Haiti, to get France to repay the money. And Aristide had created commercials which flashed the figure of more than $21 billion owed to Haiti by France. And he had commercials on public TV that talked about this. And he was promptly overthrown by the French government in a coup d'etat alongside the Canadian government and the American government, who all conspired on overthrowing Aristide. Mm-hmm. And the issue did not get nearly enough attention in the media. Aristide was widely demonized as sort of corrupt dictator, even though he was democratically elected and there were never any charges that were brought forward that proved that there was any kind of serious corruption under him. This was a campaign in which the media was highly complicit to demonize Aristide. And the issue of restitution was completely silenced in the media. I mean, what we see in the media is the interests of powerful governments and statements by powerful governments get a lot of coverage. So when we were trying to think of what we could do to get this issue talked about, it became quite clear that the best strategy would be to pretend to be the French government, because then we would get some attention. And in the end, the French government was extraordinarily helpful, more than what we would have ever dreamed of, because then when they threatened to sue us, it of course drew extraordinary international attention to the issue.
Talk more about Canada's involvement in keeping the Haitian people in debt and in slavery.
Well, Canada was heavily involved in the coup d'etat that overthrew Aristide in 2004. In fact, there was a conference that was hosted by a Canadian MP, Denis Paradis, at which Aristide's ouster was discussed months before the coup d'etat of February 29th, 2004, in which he was finally overthrown. And there were high-level Canadian officials, French officials, U.S. officials that were present at that meeting. It was reported in the French magazine L'Actualité, written by a journalist called Michel Vestel. It got very little attention outside of activist solidarity circles. But Canada had hosted a meeting at which Aristide's ouster was discussed in 2003, so the year before it happened. And Canada also played a key role in cutting off aid to the democratically elected government of Haiti under Aristide and channeling Canadian taxpayers' money for foreign aid into opposition groups that were working to destabilize the Aristide government. In February 2004, Aristide was told that if he did not leave the country, he would face massive bloodshed. In the wee hours of the morning, there were several U.S. agents who arrived at his house to tell him this. He was then forced onto a plane and flown to the Central African Republic, and with U.S. officials from the Bush administration announcing that he was no longer welcome in the hemisphere. And Canada helpfully secured the airport with the Canadian Special Forces Joint Task Force 2. So Canada has been crucially involved in this campaign by international powers to rid Haiti of Aristide, who has only just finally come back within the last week, managed to make a return to Haiti.
As what? Is he visiting or?
I mean, he's returning as a private Haitian citizen.
Hmm.
The Haitian Constitution doesn't have any provision that makes involuntary exile legitimate. So, mm-hmm. I mean, he has always had the right to return, but many governments have faced pressure to keep him out of Haiti, especially from the U.S. government. Some of this material has come out recently through WikiLeaks, the extent of U.S. government pressure to keep Aristide out of Haiti.
Is this particular crime campaign, is it still going on?
Yes. Well, the prank announcement was a pretty crucial event in drawing international attention to some campaigns that had been going on for some time before. And we were in touch with members of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network, which has played a crucial role in putting together a petition on this issue, and also with the Canada-Haiti Action Network, which is active here in Canada and has long brought attention to this issue. And in the wake of the prank, we then had a letter that came out that was published in the French national daily newspaper Libération, which was signed by a lot of prominent activists and also by intellectuals, artists, authors from around the world, including Noam Chomsky, Naomi Klein, the French farm activist José Bové, several members of the European Parliament, members of NGOs in countries ranging from Haiti, Nigeria, a lot of debt relief activists from the UK and from France also signed on, a lot of French academics, including some leading philosophers like Alain Badiou, Etienne Balibar. So it was really interesting working on getting support for this letter, seeing how broad the opinion in support of restitution really was. I mean, everybody that we asked, from academics to artists, filmmakers in France, they all wanted to be on part of this letter. And so I think it really shows that there's very fertile ground for pushing this campaign further. And actually, I was just at a press conference 2 weeks ago with a leading Haitian human rights lawyer, Mario Joseph, who works with a Haitian human rights group called the Bureau des Avocats International. And he had approached me. He was recently visiting Canada and doing some talks and press conferences. And he asked me to come to Haiti and help, like, do some follow-up with what crime had done, because he is planning a campaign that hopefully will result in a legal case against France. And he has collaborators in progressive French legal circles who are very interested in doing some follow-up with this. So hopefully we're going to see a lawsuit in the future go forward around this independence debt and finally getting France to repay Haiti.
On the near replica of the French Foreign Ministry's website that crime had created, there was also a letter posted on it in August 2010 with the signatories of Naomi Klein, Noam Chomsky, and other many prominent activists. Can you talk about that letter?
Yeah, well, that was the letter that was published in the French daily national newspaper Libération. And we had, I mean, dozens of people sign on. I think there were more than 100 people who signed on to that letter. And they were people from around the world, including European members of parliament who were also very prominent French citizens, like José Bové, the French farm activist. There were people from Friends of the Earth Nigeria who signed on. There were people from the Jubilee Debt Campaign, which is campaign to eliminate third world debt. There were people from French NGOs. There were leading French philosophers like Alain Badiou, Etienne Balibar. There, as you mentioned, Naomi Klein signed on, Noam Chomsky signed on. So it was really a broad, there were French filmmakers as well who signed on, and many authors and academics. And so it was really a broad-based, a letter showing how broad-based the support for the restitution of the independence debt really was. And it took issue with the French government's response to the prank, and also pointed out that, gee, it's not that different from how French has generally treated this issue. I mean, Haiti won independence and abolished slavery. France responded by making Haiti pay for that. Haiti's democratically elected president raised the issue of how France should pay Haiti back in 2003. He was promptly overthrown. And now we have this group of activists who staged a prank to draw attention to the issue, and France goes forward threatening legal action and telling the activists they will have to pay. So it was a letter that strongly condemned the French government's role, present and historical, and called for a different course of action based on just paying Haiti back the money.
This prank that crime had done, it's consistent with the Yes Men style pranks, where in the court of public opinion, the messages being relayed are supported. For people who would like to do these Yes Men style pranks, what's being termed as prank activism, which are pranks that bring important truths into the media, what advice do you have for people interested in that? Because there are, understandably, certain hesitancies which come from certain repercussions that people partaking in these pranks may face. And for those who don't know, that Yes Men are Andy Bickelbaum and Mike Bonanno. And they are most well known for their two films, one that came out in 2003, The Yes Men, and the second came out in 2009 called The Yes Men Fix the World. They impersonate big-time criminals, like big corporations and leaders, who put profits ahead of everything else in order to publicly humiliate them using media.
Well, I think different people have different, depending on your own, I mean, I think immigration status is often a significant factor in terms of what kinds of action
right.
people feel comfortable taking, and also people's history with the police. And like, so I think that there are different, people are differently positioned to
right.
be able to take, action that may have some sort of repercussion with the law. And I think you need to be clear about where you stand before taking a course of action, and just think out what could be the repercussions and what are you willing to risk. And at the same time, with this particular action, we really embraced anything the French government said about legal repercussions, because it really makes a prank into a big media story when there is a threat of a lawsuit. So when the French government said that they were thinking of taking legal action against us, we couldn't have planned it out better. We absolutely embraced their response, because it highlighted how unwilling France is to have a discussion about this issue. And I think that makes it a really it makes it much more interesting for journalists. Like, it's like, wow, France is responding in such an extreme way. Why is that? And then inevitably it leads you to the issue of, well, maybe it's because they really are embarrassed about this issue, because it's really embarrassing. And journalists saw that automatically, like, wow, France really is embarrassed of this issue. Look at the actions they're taking, and let's take another look at this issue. And then they looked closely into it, and it's the kind of issue that has escaped public attention only because it has been so heavily suppressed. Discussion about it has been so heavily suppressed. I mean, to the length that a democratically elected government who was trying to talk about it got overthrown. Well, that wasn't the only factor in Aristide's overthrow, but it was an important factor.
Mm-hmm.
And so it highlighted just what the stakes in this issue are. And what we saw instantly was that journalists who might have been quite uncritical on the whole of France's role in Haiti were suddenly talking about the fact that this really questionable indemnity had been paid. And the historical facts are on the side of the activists calling for restitution. And even in 1825, it wasn't legal for France to extort that money. France was already the signatory of two international treaties that called for the elimination of the slave trade. And in demanding that Haiti pay compensation for the slaves, France was involved in a very high-level transaction that was part of the slave trade. So there's no justification for it. Even in 1825, it was hard to justify. But in 2011 or 2010, when this action took place, in the court of world public opinion, this is just one that France can't possibly win. And I think that is what explains their really quite unstrategic responses and efforts to shut down debate by any means necessary, like making phone calls, sending text messages to activists, threatening them that they will have to pay, overthrowing a democratically elected government. The stakes are really big.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can push this issue further, it's a very strong case for reparations for slavery, because basically what we're talking about is not a normal reparations case. We're talking about a case where the former slaves had to pay reparations to the slave owners.
Yeah.
And there's a paper trail. I think what people don't understand is that the sum that was extorted from Haiti was calculated on the basis of tabulations, detailed tabulations, that the French government requested that all of the French colonists who had inhabited the former French colony of Saint-Domingue that became Haiti submitted. The former colonists were asked to submit tabulations listing all of their lost property, including the slaves and each slave's estimated value. The French government then took those tabulations and came up with this exorbitant sum that it said Haiti owed to France. the paper trail is there. There is a receipt for this amount mm-hmm. that Haiti paid to France. So it's such a clear-cut case of a former colonizer being really morally obliged to pay back this extorted money. And in opening up this can of worms, it also opens the door to all kinds of really interesting discussions about reparations for slavery and colonialism all over the world. And I think that that is why we've seen such an extraordinarily strong and really quite unreasonable reaction on the part of the French government, is because there is so much at stake. It opens up so many cans of worms. It's the legitimacy of the entire world system mm-hmm. that can be questioned with this one issue of restitution of Haiti's independence debt.
How is it that fake news is readily acceptable by the majority of professional journalists, if you can call them that?
Yeah, well, I think the yes men have really pioneered this approach of getting pranks out as legitimate news. And their goal is never to fool journalists for more than a few minutes or more than a day. But they are using the tactics of public relations. They insert prank news into the normal circulation of news, and then it gets picked up because the media system is increasingly reliant on press releases. So it sort of takes advantage of these mechanisms that actually guarantee that most of the news we read is pretty unvetted, often comes from press releases, often does not have enough digging. There's a real lacuna, particularly of investigative journalism, looking behind what is reported in press releases. And so it takes this kind of activism takes advantage of that circulation and the generally quite low standards that exist for journalists picking up things as news stories, especially if these news stories come from supposedly respectable agents like the Chamber of Commerce of the United States, which has billions and billions of dollars that it puts into PR and which is able to play a huge role in shaping the media. And governments are another really important agent of information and often misinformation mm-hmm. in the media system. And I think that the case, if you can look at a lot of the Yes Men's successful pranks, like most notoriously their interview with the BBC, in which they announced that Dow Chemical was going to pay compensation for the victims of the Bhopal catastrophe, which they actually were able to make this announcement to millions of people and generated like 800 articles in the American press because they had managed to insert themselves into this very problematic media system that we unfortunately rely on. But in our case, we actually had very little pickup before the French government stepped in and denounced us. So really, our action rested for its success on the French government, like almost wholly on the French government. They did the PR for
really,
us.
Really? You guys didn't send out a lot of press releases, or how
we
did you?
We sent out a press release, but there was a breakdown in our system of sending it out. We were working with no budget, and we were testing out a new system of sending it out via a moderated list. But I think we got too ambitious and added too many media contacts to the list, and spam filters picked it up. So it was we were addressing this problem as the French government chimed in itself, denouncing us. And we had started getting responses from journalists. We'd initially sent it out through this system we tried to develop that ended up not working. And we realized it wasn't going anywhere. So then we were following up with press releases to individual journalists, which was extraordinarily time consuming, but we were sort of slogging through it. And then all of a sudden, the French government, it was sort of the middle of the night in North America, but the morning in France, and French journalists were asking the French government, so what is your take on this thing, this like announcement? And the French government was like, this is a hoax. These people who are behind it, we don't know who they are, but we're going to investigate. And this is copyright infringement and all these things. Right. They charged us with all these things. And so it became a scandal in France. And we really have the French government to thank for that, because they did our work for us. We were there trying so hard to be seen as the French government, but then the French government decided that they would, the real French government decided that they would denounce us. And so that really made our campaign.
And so this was on no budget. It just makes you wonder what the billions of dollars is being spent on with the mainstream media machine.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, there's the PR industry is a huge industry, and unfortunately, it's been shown that they have great success in getting their messages into the media. Press releases play a huge role in a lot of what is reported as news.
Mm-hmm.
And even on TV, there's been an increasing trend of reliance on these basically what are press releases that pretend to be news that are sent out to news organizations. And because a lot of news organizations are facing really strapped budgets, they will just recycle this content that is press releases and pass it off as local news. So this is, yeah, obviously a very worrying trend, but it also, and it guarantees that we don't hear a lot of important information and instead our news is filled with fluff. But I think the brilliance of this prankster activism that has been pioneered by the Yes Men is that we look at that system and we find opportunities. It's sort of like an artist working with a new medium. So you take as your medium the media with all of its problems and strange contradictions, and you find the opportunities for how can we use this very, very flawed system that generally sabotages democratic processes. How can we use this system to make a point that is ultimately about the truth? How can mm-hmm. how can we use this system to slip the truth in there and use these channels of public relations tactics and sloppy journalism to get something that's more true than what we'd usually get in the media into the news?
The creators of the Yes Men, Andy Biglebaum and Mike Bonanno. Well, at least I've heard Andy Biglebaum say this. He had said that they expose truths, but they don't create lies or sustain them. So the whole purpose is to expose the truths in a prank way. So.
Yes, which is quite different from how real public relations works, mm-hmm. which is to spin news in a sustained way through suppressing facts and highlighting certain truths that are good for profit making, but which are often not actually truth and often are lies. So this activity is a subversion of that system because it's using similar tactics, but the aims are quite different. The aims are to reveal a truth, even if it flies in the face of corporate profits.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, I would just check out, if you are interested in staging your own prank, you can check out the resources at theyesmen.org. And they have how-to tips. So there's no reason you cannot start concocting your own prank to reveal the truth about some issue that is being suppressed in the media.
Such a significantly constructive prank on a zero budget, even. A massive, massive round of applause to you, Laurence, and to Team Committee for the repayment of the indemnity money expropriated from Haiti.
It's basically just being willing to put in a lot of time. But I think that's the case with any activist work. And it has amazing potential for having fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can reach different kinds of audiences through using humor. And you can, and it's also, and I think a lot of people get burned out on doing the same kind of activism. So it represents a way for people to use their skills to come at an issue in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I think for everybody who was involved, I think I can safely say that we all found it really refreshing to come at this issue in a different way. And I think what you're doing also, I mean, I think I've piled a lot of blame on journalists for allowing the media to be used a lot of the time by public relations professionals to spin the news for profit. But I think when it comes down to it, a lot of journalists are interested in talking about the issues that are hard to talk about in the corporate media. I think they're bored at the kind of work they're forced to do on the daily beat of whatever they're covering.
Mm-hmm.
And they recognize that there are issues that should be talked about, but that aren't talked about. And so what we do with these kinds of pranks is we give an opportunity for the journalists who are more interesting, who aspire to more interesting work, to talk about things like Haiti's independence debt in their stories about foreign aid that usually it would just not pass in a corporate media system. Mm-hmm. But we suddenly give them an opportunity to talk about that. And there you find very quickly that you have a lot of allies. As an activist, you realize you have allies in the media who come forward. And after we put out our press release about the restitution, there were a lot of journalists who said, "That was great. We loved it. We'd love to learn who you are and more about this." And they were excited. So, I mean, it's a sort of interesting collaboration. You create a story that is interesting for the journalists, and you create it in such a way that you know that it has a chance of passing through into the media system and that the journalists will be able to run with it if they want to. And you suddenly find yourself in an interesting partnership with journalists, all in the name of reporting something that would not ordinarily make its way into the media. And the journalists seemed just as excited as we were about this prospect.
Nice. Well, thank you so much, Laurence.
You're very welcome.
You've just been listening to an interview with Laurence Fabre, member of the Committee for the Reimbursement of the Indemnity Money Extorted from Haiti, otherwise known as CRIME.